Hello and welcome to our program Travel, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Jeff, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from various travel outlets here on OWL Radio. Let's get started with an article from the San Antonio Express News in the Another View section entitled Bus Line Could Transform I-35 Corridor. This is by Melissa Cabello Havrada for the Express News. It's a staple of San Antonio life to bemoan driving Interstate 35 to Austin. The road is congested, dangerous, and nerve-wracking. Every day it carries 100,000 cars and 40-ton semis. The situation is not going to improve in the foreseeable future. We're playing catch-up on I-35 congestion, and we're overdue on new ideas to provide relief. The solution I most prefer is rapid rail, but the idea died in a bog of rail availability and right-of-way challenges. It's time for a new approach. This is where an interurban bus can make a difference. It's an idea former HUD Secretary Henry Cisneros has been championing. It's been a perfect solution, but it is a solid first step toward creating lasting change. The IUB is a dedicated bus that travels between San Antonio and Austin with stops in New Braunfels and San Marcos. It's also a first step toward a transformational vision that harnesses the energy of the burgeoning I-35 corridor. The proposal is for a two-year, $1.5 million proof-of-concept pilot, and I believe it's worth the effort. San Antonio and Austin are dynamic cities that are growing together. It's projected that by 2030, 7 million people will be living along the I-35 corridor. The need for connectivity is well studied and documented. It would be irresponsible to not act to relieve the congestion, address the danger of I-35, and enhance connectivity. There is a considerable price tag and the proper stewardship of public funds is my priority. The plan at first is for the IUB to travel along I-35 with the rest of the traffic. Subsequent phases could include dedicated lanes, increased frequency, more buses, and greater capacity for passengers. The plan calls for San Antonio to carry the bulk of the expense. That would be roughly $780,000, but the burden can be negotiated among the 8 political jurisdictions and 2 transit systems involved. Funds could also come from a variety of grants as well as the federal government. 2 buses are at the ready, provided by our partners in Austin, saving development time and money. The vision is for the San Antonio-Austin IUB to prove the need and be a springboard for the development of an eventual I-35 rapid rail that will take our region to the next level of competitiveness. While parts of the plan still need to be worked out, leadership and political will are needed to get it done. The plan has room for input. We should have a serious discussion about access for people on San Antonio's west and south sides. Station locations, timeliness, and affordability should not be barriers for riders. We should also look for creative ways to map the ultimate I-35 rapid rail goal. Our community put together a rail district in an effort to land the Toyota plant. We can learn from that experience. The San Antonio-Austin corridor will be an economic super region rivaling Dallas-Fort Worth. One key is upgrading our infrastructure. The IUB proof of concept pilot project is a solid step in that direction. I believe San Antonio should take the lead, create momentum, and drive toward the future. As chair of the city's council's Transportation and Mobility Committee, I plan to be a catalyst with my colleagues for the region's future and move the IUB pilot forward. All the entities involved are on board. It's time for a spark to make it happen. City Councilwoman Melissa Cabello Havra represents District 6, and I apologize for butchering her name. Our next article was also from the Express News under Destinations, and it's entitled, Interest in Jacob's Well Rises After TikTok Calls It Scary. This is by Shepard Price, who's a staff writer. Jacob's Well may have run dry in August, but according to a viral TikTok, the spring in Wimberley remains one of the scariest spots in Texas. The TikTok video, posted October 15th, has almost 400,000 views and more than 30,000 likes. The 10-second video was posted by the account at TX Vacation, which highlights destinations around the state, including the Tower of the Americas and the Riverwalk. It's 140 feet deep, the video states, showing the center of the spring and how dark the water gets as it drops out. The video is set to spooky music from the Netflix TV show Stranger Things. The average depth of Jacob's Well is 120 feet. Cave divers from the Jacob's Well Exploration Project have explored and mapped the system. Two principal conduits comprise the system, with one passageway measuring 4,500 feet from the surface with a maximum depth of 137 feet. Between 1964 and 1984, 9 open water divers died in Jacob's Well. At least a dozen people have died scuba diving in the spring, according to the Houston Chronicle. With my luck, this is where I drop my car keys, one TikTok user commented on the video. Many said the well was not scary, but beautiful. It's a very beautiful and magical place. I hate to see it so dry, one TikTok user commented. Jacob's Well is a spring located in Wimberley in Hays County. In August, officials closed the spring to swimming for the remainder of the year because of drought conditions. The Trinity Aquifer, which supplies Jacob's Well, needed significant rainfall when the decision to shut down the well was made. Earlier this year, for just the fourth time in recorded history, the well ran dry. Our next article is from the SF Gate, and it's entitled, Why the Little-Known Splendor of Great Basin National Park is Worth the Drive. This is by Sam Moore of the SF Gate. For a number of reasons, I tend to steer clear of national parks. Take Yosemite, for example. While the place is undeniably one of a kind, a trip to one of the national forests or wilderness areas right outside the park's borders can still offer towering granite cliffs, alpine lakes, lush valleys, rushing rivers, and waterfalls, all without having to pay an entrance fee or surround yourself with throngs of summertime crowds. You can find beautiful, secluded, free campsites up most dirt roads in a national forest, instead of paying for spots in cramped campgrounds that fill up months in advance. Unlike in national parks, dogs are allowed on hiking trails in national forest. I could go on and on. Despite all the smack I talk, I recently leaped at the chance to drive nearly 10 hours across the entire width of California and Nevada to spend 2 nights at Great Basin National Park. My reason was simple. I knew it would be worth it. Great Basin is a 77,180-acre national park near the Nevada-Utah border, nestled among the mountains of the Southern Snake Range and surrounded by hundreds of miles of desert in every direction. Salt Lake City, the metropolitan area closest to the park, is a 3.5-hour drive away. It's 4.5 hours from Las Vegas, 6 hours from Reno, and a whopping 9.5 hours from my home in Oakland. The closest town is Baker, Nevada, population 36, which sits right outside the park's entrance. While this remoteness might be daunting to some, for others, including myself, it's part of what makes the place so special. Ultimately, it's the isolation that makes the park very much worthwhile, said Jason Wirtz, one of Great Basin's park rangers. It's something that you don't get a lot of in national parks, that sense of isolation, that sense of being out here and away from everything. That's something that a lot of people seek out. That's a big part of why my opinions on other national parks don't really apply to Great Basin. I've never been faced with a crowd of people there or had any problems finding a last-minute campsite, even on weekends in the summertime. There's no $35 entrance fee. Parking is always plentiful at trailheads, visitor centers, and scenic points. Dogs still aren't allowed on hiking trails, but hey, you can't win them all. Getting to the park from California requires a trip along U.S. Highway 50, dubbed the loneliest road in America by Life magazine in 1986. This lengthy two-lane stretch is one of my favorite parts of the Great Basin experience. It takes you past seas of sagebrush and herds of wild burros, and occasionally through old mining towns where you can sit in a saloon and eat a doggone good burger in the company of several deer and elk heads mounted to the wood-paneled walls. Blissful seclusion and long drive aside, Great Basin is a wonder in itself. Driving into the park in the heart of autumn, I had a difficult time keeping my jaws shut. Groves of quaking aspens scattered among pine, juniper, and spruce trees stood in shocks of bright gold along the hillsides, always with a backdrop of soaring, rugged mountain peaks. Tucked away in those mountains is Nevada's only glacier, which sits at the base of 13,000-foot Wheeler Peak. Below that, you'll find ancient bristlecone pine trees, including the remains of the famous Prometheus tree, once recorded as the oldest tree in the world. After hiking up past the tree line, I found it impossible to comprehend that some of the majestic, gnarled pines in front of me had been around since the end of the Stone Age. One of the most coveted features of the park is its night sky views. Great Basin is designated as an International Dark Sky Park, an area specifically protected from light pollution. This lends itself to stargazing, so incredible, I sat shivering in the dark for hours each night just to gaze above me and take it all in. These are some of the best night skies in the whole country, Mr. Wirtz said. It's very, very dark out here, one of the darkest national parks in the whole system. What's also dark is the park's 8-million-year-old cave system, a sprawling labyrinth of growing mineral deposits that hang from the cave's ceilings and creep up from its floors in underground rooms that make you feel like you've left planet Earth. On an hour-long tour of the caves, Wirtz told me they got their name, Lehman Caves. Lehman Caves, from Absalon Lehman, a rancher who likely discovered the caves after one of his cows fell into them from an opening in the ground. Before that, they were used for thousands of years by the Western Shoshone, Goshute, the Ute, Paiute, and Washoe people, who left paintings on the cave's walls that still exist today. On my way back to Oakland, I took a detour to soak in some desert hot springs, the name of which I've promised not to share. While neck deep in steaming geothermal water, I bonded with a stranger about the bristlecone pine trees I'd just left behind. She groaned when I told her of my plans to write about Great Basin. "Now everyone will know about my favorite place," she said. "Yeah," I told her, "but how many of them will actually make the trip?" That article was written by Sam Moore. Sam Moore is a trending news reporter for SF Gate. He grew up in Long Beach and studied journalism at San Francisco State. Our next article is from the Express News. Under tourism, a new perspective on Niagara Falls. This is by Laura Randall, a Washington Post staff writer. For more than a century, the imposing bow arch style building perched beside Horseshoe Falls harnessed the fierce flow of the Niagara River to bring electricity to western New York and southern Ontario. Now, Canada's first major hydroelectric power station is the newest major tourist attraction on the Canadian side of the falls. Amid a sea of commercialized activities that include zip lines, casinos, and a climate-controlled skywheel, the Niagara Park's power station offers visitors a unique perspective of one of the world's most famous natural wonders. Decommissioned in 2006, the power station sat idle for years until the Niagara Park's Commission, the self-funded government agency that oversees the area, took over and set in motion a plan to bring it back to life as a tourist attraction. After a nearly $19 million renovation, the 65,000 square foot main hall opened to the public in July 2021, followed a year later by a walkable tunnel that ends at a large platform with unparalleled views of the entire Niagara Gorge. The viewing platform at the end of the tunnel was the finishing touch of the restoration and is a key step in understanding the hydroelectric process from start to finish. Visitors descend by glass elevator to the wheel pit, where they follow the same path the spent water once took on its way back to the lower Niagara River. Here, the close-up views of Horseshoe Falls emphasize the power of the water and how it was harnessed back in the 1900s to generate electricity. Beginning operation in 1905, using patents developed by Nikola Tesla and George Westinghouse, the facility is one of the few power stations from the early 20th century to close with all its equipment intact, said Marcelo Grusso, Senior Director of Engineering and Parks Operation at the Niagara Parks Commission. The people who worked at the Canadian Niagara Power Company took exceptional care and pride in it, he said. Everything you could imagine was still there when it closed. They even left the drawing board. Grusso and his team had access to 1,500 archival photos dating as far back as 1901, chronicling every step of the build, he said. That included the construction of a huge temporary cofferdam to divert the thundering water from the building site. More than a century later, workers used modern technology and tools to build a similar watertight enclosure to hold back the river so they could reinforce the walls. Then there's the marvel that is the tail race tunnel, the channel that discharged the tailwater back to the river. Built in the early 1900s with little more than pickaxes, shovels, and rudimentary dynamite. Engineers weren't sure what they would find when they first explored the idea of opening a tunnel to visitors. They built a swing stage, a scaffolding platform akin to those used in high-rise window cleaning, that allowed them access to the cavernous space beneath the power station to assess the tunnel's condition. Once we saw how incredibly good the condition of the tunnel was after 100 years of use, we said, okay, we definitely have a winner here, he said. On a recent visit, a dozen or so visitors stood on the platform, basking in the sunny morning and unobstructed views of the Niagara Gorge. Horseshoe Falls felt stunningly close, its rushing water a soundtrack that invited lingering. The Maid of the Mist and Hornblower boat cruises, long a fixture of Niagara tourism, barreled past, carrying poncho-clad passengers to and from the base of the falls. It offers a whole new perspective on the lower Niagara River, said David Adames, the commission's chief executive. The power station is an easy walk from Table Rock Center, a prime shopping and eating hub in Queen Victoria Park. Yet it feels far removed from the bustling, selfie-taking crowds that tend to dominate the area. A landscaped walkway leads past a key piece of hydroelectric equipment known as an exciter unit, now a blue and white art installation, to the main entrance. It's the first hint that the experience ahead might go beyond a typical nuts and bolts engineering tour. Inside, the light-filled generator hall features 51 large arch windows, limestone and granite floors, and the original 14-foot-high red brass doors, each weighing 3,500 pounds. Interactive exhibits, vintage photographs, and repurposed artifacts show how the water entered the building via a 575-foot-long forebay, then flowed through huge steel tubes known as penstocks to spin the blades and turbines that powered the generators to produce electricity. Visitors can opt for a self-guided or guided tour of the power station's main hall. which intersperses history exhibits with interactive displays and original equipment such as motorized oil switches, giant wrenches, and all 11 alternating current generators, painted a striking robin's egg blue. Computerized screens hooked up to an original control panel let children test their hydropower knowledge and solve simulated emergencies. There are also exhibits detailing Nikola Tesla's groundbreaking inventions and his famous DC versus AC currents war with Thomas Edison. A pay-in to female scientists and staffers, and a scale model of the plant as it looked during peak operation. The gift shop is also a must-see, not only for its eclectic selection, like Tesla socks, upcycled beer glasses, triple gear wall clocks, but also for its location beside a 100-foot section of the original forebay, where water from the Niagara River first entered the power station. Visitors can peer over a glass protector to observe the inner forebay, which, through underwater arches, filtered the incoming water into the plant before it churned through the penstocks. In the evening, the power station hosts Currents, Niagara's Power Transformed, a sleek, highly immersive light and sound show that brings the machinery to life through music, special laser effects, and 3D mapping and imagery. About 200,000 people visited the power station in its first year of operation, according to the commission. With the tunnels opening in July, officials expect the number to grow to 300,000 to 350,000 annual visitors, thanks in part to the attraction's ability to appeal to a wide range of interest levels, said Adames, the CEO. There are so many stories to tell, starting with those who are simply curious about what's behind those beautiful stone walls, he added. There's the story of hydroelectric generation, the story of innovators at the turn of the century, the human story of the people who worked in the plant, and the competition of the people building power plants on both sides of the border. It has all of it. Our next article is from the AAA Explorer magazine. Mandela now open at Bush Library and Museum. The Bush Library Museum is excited to welcome Mandela, the official exhibition, detailing the life of one of the world's most famous freedom fighters. The epic story of Nelson Mandela is told in a series of experiential galleries. From his rural childhood home through years of turbulent struggle against the apartheid regime, to his eventual vindication and final years as South Africa's first democratically elected president. The exhibition is now open through April 23 of 2023. George H.W. Bush had already garnered an impressive list of titles before his election as the nation's 41st president. Bush served as a U.S. congressman, ambassador to the United Nations, Republican Party chairman, chief liaison to China, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and vice president. This illustrious past, his term as president, his military service during World War II, and his successful business career are detailed throughout the exhibitions and archives of the Bush Library and Museum. Museum highlights include actual film footage of Bush's submarine rescue after his plane was shot down over the island of Chichihima in September 1944, an interactive study of the timeline leading up to the Gulf War, examples of gifts given to President Bush when he met with foreign heads of state, and replicas of both the Oval Office and Camp David office. The Bush Center grounds have much to offer. Visitors can view the sculpture The Day the Wall Came Down, a composition of five bronze horses leaping over a reproduction of Berlin Wall rubble, signifying the long-awaited freedom of the East German people. In the center of the plaza is a statue of George Bush, which is 8 feet tall and composed of granite and bronze. The Barbara Bush Rose Gardens and the Presidential Pond provide an area to relax and reflect, and have been the backdrop for countless marriage proposals, family and group photos, picnics, and peaceful strolls. The Bush Library Museum is in College Station, Texas. Our next article is also from AAA magazine, AAA Explorer magazine. Louisiana North Shore on Lake Pontchartrain. Since the 1800s, the North Shore of Lake Pontchartrain has beckoned people across. Today, the Louisiana North Shore remains the destination where life slows down. Explore unique attractions, a delectable culinary scene, and verdant expanses of the great outdoors. St. Tammany Parish's distinctive communities are packed with personality and charm. On the North Shore, you'll love getting to know artsy Abita Springs, Mandeville by the Lake, historic Covington, Maritime Madisonville, and Old Town Slidell. Tammany Taste. The North Shore offers sophisticated restaurants and award-winning chefs, mom-and-pop eateries, craft breweries, including Abita Brewing Company, and sweet bakeries. Dine on outdoor patios that welcome your furry family members, too, including Hambone, Abita Brew Pub, and Restaurant Cote. The locally sourced Tammany Taste culinary scene offers fresh Louisiana seafood, packed with pleasure gumbo, overstuffed po' boys, and comfort food with flavor. Rejoice in our waterfront views from inviting restaurant patios, including the Anchor, Pat's Rest-A-While, and Palmetto's on the Bayou. Outdoor Adventures. Soft Adventure is served up in full force for adventure seekers on Louisiana North Shore. About 80,000 acres of wildlife refuge in St. Tammany make it ideal for bird watching. Kayakers find easy access along many of the bayous and rivers and on Lake Pontchartrain. And cyclists love the 31-mile Tammany Trace. Nature lovers welcome exploration on the well-maintained hiking trails at Camp Salmon Nature Park, Big Branch Marsh National Wildlife Refuge, and North Lake Nature Center. Downtown shopping. Browse some of the South's best art in area galleries or shop for antiques in historic districts in Slidell and Covington. Decorate your home with the vibrant and colorful works of Marianne Angeli Rodriguez Gallery. Find chic finery and accessories at boutiques, including Columbia Street Mercantile and Stella and Grace. Attic to Awesome, Copper Rooster, and Lulu's Almost New are just a few shops boasting antiques and uniques that are sure to fill your trunk. That's all the time we have today. You've been listening to Travel on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Jeff saying goodbye from Owl Radio.